Subscribe to the X Podcast right now on iTunes and join me as I share terrifying experiences to satisfy even the most jaded of appetites. Tonight's edition of Mysterious Radio is brought to you by Best Fiends.
Statements and opinions by guests of Mysterious Radio are not to be considered as endorsed by sponsors or affiliated networks. Any rebroadcast, reproduction, or other use of this podcast without the express written consent of Mysterious Radio is strictly prohibited.
Get ready for a night filled with conspiracies, strange places, the paranormal, UFOs, legends, and myths from around the world. With your hosts, K-Town, on Mysterious Radio.
All right, thank you for joining me tonight for another edition of Mysterious Radio. I'm your host, K-Town, and tonight my special guest is Steve Parsons, who's here to discuss his book called Paracoustics, where he explores the science, really, behind the noises that you hear in connection with known hauntings, like the screams and the door slamming and the footsteps or whatnot. So this is going to be interesting because, you know, there's got to be a reason why it's happening. And if you're like me, many times when you're watching these paranormal shows, you're like, you know, they hear something, you're like, where the hell is that coming from? So it's good that someone has taken the time to dig into the reason why we can hear these audible sounds, you know, with our ears and not just with the audio or digital recorders that they always use. Steven also has a website. It's called theghosthunter.webs.com. And he also has a book called Ghostology that you can pick up off Amazon as well. Now, before we bring him out, I want to say that Alien Expo went as well as expected for a first-time event. We had almost 1,000 people come through for those 2 days, and I met a lot of prominent retired professionals that came through, including some NASA scientists, former and current military. I met the deputy of or chief of operations for the mayor here in Knoxville. He was there to take in some of the presentations, as well as a mayor from Ohio, from a city in Ohio. And she was a pleasure to meet as well. I do want to say that I want to thank the ones or the Mysterious Radio fans that have been listening since 2016 that I met there as well. That was great to see that you traveled and came all the way out to support Alien Expo, being that, you know, this is a very important event for us. And we have more to come. So I want to tell you real quick that if you're in the vicinity of Knoxville, one or two states over, we have Nick Pope coming to the UT Conference Center on March the 14th, and that's from 8 a.m. to 5 a.m., and he's going to be joined by Peter Robbins. These tickets cannot be bought at the door. You have to buy these online, and you can do it at alienexpo.com, or you can do it at eventbrite.com. Now, if you're into spirituality and life after death, and you want to get a reading or connect with fantastic psychic mediums, I have the psychic cop, Chuck Bergman. He's also going to be coming to Knoxville, and joining him will be Rob Gutro, whom I will be bringing up on an interview shortly, you know, in the next couple of weeks. He's a psychic medium, but he's also a pet psychic, so he can communicate with pets that have passed away as well. That's going to be from 8 to 5 p.m. On March the 14th at the UT Conference Center. And with those passes, you're going to get a continental breakfast, lunch, and unlimited beverages for the Nick Pope and the Peter Robbins exclusive presentation that day. There's only 250 seats available. And then for Chuck Bergman and Rob Gutro, there's only 120 seats available. So if you want to come and you know it, you need to get your passes now. I will say that hotels are very reasonable in the Knoxville area. So if you go to Hotwire or Priceline or whatnot, you're going to find that, like I said, hotels are really cheap here. So that's good for your knowledge and your planning. So please go over and like the Alien Expo Facebook page, please, if you haven't yet. That will help us a great deal in continuing to do these events, because it all rolls back to Mysterious Radio. And really, our ultimate goal is to just be able to be self-sufficient and to roll out as many shows as we can for you guys. Now, Patreon supporters, really, I mean, we give all thanks to Patreon supporters. Without you guys, none of this would be possible. Alien Expo will not be possible. Hoping to build something bigger, and we will do that. As long as you guys have our backs, do what you can. If you can't join Patreon, you know, share our stuff, like our stuff, tell other people about the show, and, you know, join when you can. It's as little as $5, and you guys get access to over 230 some odd special editions and our archives to listen to as much as you want. So thank you to all of our continued hardcore Patreon supporters. All right, here now. All right, so let's get on with the show. Here now is my special guest, Steve Parsons, here to discuss sounds in the paranormal. All right, my special guest tonight is author and paranormal investigator Stephen Parsons to discuss his book, Paracoustics. This book examines the physics and psychology of sound and its association with the paranormal. Stephen, I want to thank you very much for joining me tonight on Mysterious Radio.
No, it's my pleasure.
I appreciate your time. I really do. Now, if you don't mind, to start off by telling us how you got your start investigating the paranormal.
Oh, gosh. That's a really difficult question to answer. I guess it comes from childhood and just a desire to want to see ghosts. I'd read about, you know, I'd read stories of ghosts. Most children do. But I wanted to go a little further. I desperately wanted to see a ghost of my own. And so I started visiting haunted buildings, asking my parents to take me to spooky castles, and it kind of must have developed from there into wanting to develop it further, although that came a little later in life.
Now, the term paracoustics is something that I've never heard of. So do you mind telling us what it is and how it relates to the studies of parapsychology?
Well, it's a word that myself and my co-author, Cal Cooper, Dr. Cal Cooper, invented. And it's just an amalgam of the word paranormal and acoustics, because acoustics, of course, relates to sound. And we were looking for a title, and it just seemed to be a neat, encompassing word that described the subject that we were interested most in writing about. So it's a made up word.
Okay. All right. Well, that's fine. That's fine. It's a great word, actually, to describe what you guys are studying. So from your perspective, is the science community taking this study more seriously concerning the paranormal?
Science has always had a love-hate relationship with the paranormal. I work alongside many academic parapsychologists. Right in the very early days of paranormal studies, it still is called psychical research. There were a number of universities and academics dotted around the UK, the USA, and Europe, who were interested in the phenomena. You had, in the 1840s, you had the Fox sisters in Hydesville, New York State, claiming that they were communicating with the spirit of a dead peddler through a series of knocks and raps. And there have been earlier cases going through the 17th and 16th century, way, way back to ancient Roman times. But what was different with the Fox sisters is it spawned a a mass interest, almost a cult following, a development of seances. People started to do seances, they started to do table tipping, they started to engage in mediumship in the home in a way that had never been undertaken before. And they started to make some extraordinary claims. They claimed that they were able to communicate with spirits, and that the spirits were interacting through table tipping or Ouija boards or other devices. And some scientists took this seriously, and they studied it. There were several eminent scientists: Michael Faraday, the physicist, Robert Herr, the American chemist, were amongst the vanguard of those scientists who were interested. What has happened in recent years, and I should really add, it was happening right from the start, because a lot of the peers and colleagues of these eminent men ridiculed what they were doing. You know, they scorned any idea that they were spending time with this hocus pocus witchcraft nonsense of people talking to the dead and the dead communicating with the living. So they did have quite a struggle to retain credibility, and a number of careers did suffer as a result of it. And science still has that love-hate relationship with the paranormal. Individually, there are a number of scientists who study the phenomena and the reports, and there are one or two universities around the world that have dedicated departments for the study of paranormal phenomena. Most notably in the United States, in North Carolina, it's the Ryan Institute. And here in the United Kingdom, we have the psychology departments at Northampton University, and Edinburgh in Scotland also have a dedicated parapsychology department. However, there are still many who even work in that field of parapsychology who are quite skeptical and quite dismissive. And they maintain that what they're really studying is a phenomena of the human mind, that these people are subject to hallucinations, to their own wants and desires and their beliefs, and that they're fooling themselves, or that they are being fooled by ordinary events and misinterpreting them. So there is this dualistic love-hate relationship between science and the paranormal that has existed since the earliest days and hasn't changed in the 21st century.
As much as we all love true crime, paranormal, and conspiracy-related topics, there comes a time when we have to decompress, relax, and have some good, challenging fun. Well, I've got just the thing for you. Join our team as we play the game called Best Fiends. I would describe it as a puzzle game combined with a battle game. It has amazing graphics, colors, and sounds. Plus, it has tons of levels, with more being added every month. So you can literally play this game for hours on end, blow everything off that you have to do, and not feel guilty. Because Best Fiends requires critical thinking. Downloaded over 100 million times globally. I don't watch a lot of television, so this is a great game for me, and even better when I'm needing a fun distraction. Anyone can play Best Fiends. No internet required, and it's free to download. Engage your brain with fun puzzles and collect tons of cute characters too. 5-star rated mobile game on the Apple App Store and Google Play. Download free on the Apple App Store or Google Play. That's Friends without the R, Best Fiends. Again, that's Friends without the R, and the game is called Best Fiends. Join the fun now. Download Best Fiends. You mentioned, Ouija boards and seances and things like that. In your opinion, are any of those things useful in the study of parapsychology?
Well, I wouldn't like to. I think it would be naive to dismiss any of the tools that are available. Not because I necessarily believe that they are useful tools, but simply because we don't yet understand enough about the mechanisms of the human mind. We know very little, almost nothing at all, about the realm or nature of the paranormal. Most of it is theories and ideas that can't be tested. We don't know what a ghost is. on that basis, it would be naive, possibly foolish, to say, well, they can't work, they don't work. I think where I do have some issues is the idea that these pieces of cardboard or pieces of wood that have letters and numbers printed on them are in any way evil, or a portal that lets in demons, or a lot of the other lurid tales that come from associating with Ouija boards, because I think that's more the realm of Hollywood and more the realm of people's belief, rather than anything that we can realistically show any evidence for.
Okay, so let's talk about this, the sound aspect of it. First, I want to ask you, are there any historical accounts of researchers trying to pick up sounds from locations that are thought to be haunted?
Well, our ability to pick up sound is really only begins at the start of the 20th century with the advent of sound recording equipment and sound monitoring equipment. But the researchers working or examining ghost cases or paranormal reports much, much earlier in the 17th, 16th century, even, as I said earlier, in ancient Rome, all report that many of the cases have got sound associated with them. For example, in the first century AD in Athens, there was a notable haunted house which was visited and investigated by a scholar called Athenodorus. And in his account, which was written down over 2,000 years ago, he reports that the phantom appears with the sound of rattling chains and other associated noises. So sound has always been an element in people's reports of paranormal experiences. But it's only really been since the 20th century that we've started to have an ability to document sounds by recording them. There was some attempts made. In fact, there were some recordings made of seance room raps and knocks back in the very early part of the the time just following the First World War. But sadly, they've been lost. These were wax cylinder recordings that were made in Northern Ireland by a researcher called William Crawford. But sadly, we've lost them. And there are some documents that show that, for example, here in Britain, the Society for Psychical Research in the late 19th century was certainly looking towards using early sound recording equipment at a notable haunted house that they were investigating in Scotland. So as soon as the equipment, as soon as the ability to record sound became available as a tool for the investigator, then people started to use it to document by recording the sounds. We live in an age now with digital recording and easy access to sound recorders. You know, our smartphones have them. So it's very much more prevalent today than it was 50 years ago or 20 years ago.
Can you tell us what are some of the common noises one might hear from a genuine haunted location?
Every noise of human habitation has been reported, but the most noted, if we go back a little bit from genuine haunted to the first sounds associated with the paranormal, they would be knocks and raps and taps, and they came through the seance room communications, and followed on from the Fox sisters' discovery that they could communicate with the ghost of the peddler who haunted, or the spirit of the peddler who haunted their house, in a series of one rap for yes, two raps for no code. So knocks and raps were certainly amongst the very first types of sound reported. But in terms of haunted locations, then you're looking at the full range of sounds that would be associated with normal human activity: doors opening and closing, the sound of footsteps on floors, the sound of breathing, of object movement and displacement of objects. So things moving about in rooms upstairs or people moving about in rooms upstairs, and upon examination there has been nobody present, or footsteps in empty corridors. So it's the normal sounds that we would associate with human habitation, rather than anything distinctly different, you know. So the unusual aspect of the sound is not the sound itself, but the fact that there's no immediate or apparent obvious cause of the sound being made. So, for example, you might hear a voice, or you might hear a door opening when in fact there was no door movement or nobody there speaking at the time.
You told us about the sounds concerning the doors and things like that. So that would be considered sounds basically coming from a residual type haunting. That's not considered an intelligent type haunting, correct?
Well, the sounds are reported in all sorts of cases, and it's very difficult to categorize and label a haunting as residual or otherwise, because again we come to this problem of we can't define something as residual because we don't yet know how the paranormal functions. There are cases that ostensibly appear to be residual, you know, that they appear to not react or not respond to the current situation. They show no awareness of the people or the surroundings. The ghost seems to do its own thing. But equally, there are cases where there is interactivity, but there are a lot of crossover cases where both. You know, in some haunted houses, some people may experience no interactivity, while somebody else may experience activity or interactivity. So it's very difficult to separate in such a clear-cut way one type of haunting from another. I know people love the paranormal, you know, love to put labels on stuff, but labels can be misleading, and it's often a huge crossover area between types of phenomena. But sounds are universal. Sound is one of our most important senses. In fact, if not the most important sense, it's the first sense that switches on. Even when we're in the womb, we become aware of sounds around us. We become aware of the sound of our mother's voice. I used to work in nursing, and one of the most important things that we learned and were taught is that if a patient is in a coma and that they're unconscious, you continue to talk to them. And a lot of patients, when they recover from these deep states of unconsciousness, induced coma or trauma-induced coma, will report that they had a full awareness of the sounds. They could hear the voices, they could hear people talking about them. And of course, the first thing, our ability to hear sound never really switches off, which is why alarm clocks work so well. Well, they do with most people. They don't tend to with me, because sound, our hearing system alerts us because it's still running, and it alerts us to this sound, and we hopefully leap out of bed and start the day. So sound is an absolutely crucial sense. And in terms of paranormal experiences, regardless of the type of haunting, there is the most common type of experience that people report are not the sighting of apparitions or ghosts. It is sound. They've heard something unusual. They've heard a voice. They've heard a noise. They've heard a sound that they recognize as being untoward and out of place. And that, by a large proportion, outweighs all of the other types of experience that people have.
Very good. I know that I have heard some things that in my life that I can't explain, and my son is actually, even in the house we live in now, he's heard someone talking that wasn't standing there, so it scared me to death. But I do totally get that. Now, I want to know, you know, with all the available equipment out there to investigate these hauntings and to record sound, can you tell us about some of the things that or which ones that you find the most useful?
The most useful of all, first of all, are my own ears, Because what I'm there to investigate is something that is a human experience. You just described that yourself and your son have heard things in your house. So what I want to know, I'm rather like a policeman arriving after the crime, because I'm not there when you heard the sound. I'm not there when your son heard the sound. So my first is to listen to what you have to say and your description of the sound, and also to see if I can hear it too. Because if you could hear it, then I should be able to hear it as well. Beyond that, I would want to document it by recording. So I would use the highest quality audio recording equipment that I have available. We all do have sound recorders available, and they're incredibly useful. You know, our smartphones are able to very high quality recorders. So I would want to try and record it, because using a recording means that I can go away afterwards and I can look at the recorder, look at the sound that's been recorded, and examine the sound. I can look at its frequency, I can look at its amplitude, I can look at the length of time it took place over. So I can start to gain an understanding of the sound. And often you will find that the sound which the person reports as being unusual, you can often determine by examining the recording more about it, and quite often find that it has a normal explanation. The most important piece of equipment beyond me listening is the best quality audio recorder that I can have available. Now, I'm lucky. I have, audio recorders that cost several thousand dollars and that can record at very, very high quality indeed, better than broadcast quality. But my smartphone isn't very far behind. So we live in an era now where not just I, but anybody can make recordings. And I would urge you, I would urge your son and anybody that's listening to the show, if you live somewhere where you are hearing abnormal sounds, then reach for a recorder and document the sounds, record the sounds. And that's the first step towards trying to understand what's taking place.
All right, Steve. So let me ask you, are you still conducting paranormal investigations?
Oh, yes. Right as we speak, I'm actually looking at a case not very far away from here that involves the main witness hearing abnormal sounds. And this has been going on for a number of months. And she asked if somebody could come and take a look. And what we're doing at the moment is I'm visiting on a regular basis and making recordings to see if we can capture recorded documentary evidence of the sounds that she says that she's hearing. So far, we've been unlucky. We haven't managed to capture any recordings of it, but we've just given the person concerned some audio recorders. We've left them there so that we don't have the luxury of being in the location 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's impractical, but we do have the ability now with modern recording equipment to give the equipment to the person, to the witness, to the homeowner, and allow them to operate the recordings, and then we get the recordings back afterwards to look at. So yeah, that's ongoing as we speak.
All right, my special guest tonight is paranormal investigator and author Stephen Parsons, and we are discussing his book, Paracoustics. You can pick it up on Amazon, and I will have more for you when we return right after this. All right, my special guest tonight is Stephen Parsons, and we are discussing his book, Paracoustics. And now, Stephen, let's talk about EVP. I want to know, and I'm sure you use this in your personal investigations. Can you tell us some of the things that you've been able to pick up?
Well, actually, I don't. I don't use electronic voice phenomena as part of my investigations unless I'm in a situation where that has been a phenomenon that's been reported by the witness, in which case I will examine a recording.
Okay, so tell us why you don't include that in your investigation.
Well, the electronic voice phenomenon is certainly not a new phenomenon. It goes back to the invention of the telephone and the radio and recording apparatus at right at the end of the 19th century. And almost as soon as these devices were invented, people started to say that the spirits were communicating, first of all, through the telephone, through radios, and then onto recordings. There were different attributions given at the time. Some people claimed that they were the voices of deceased, of spirits. Others said that they were aliens from other planets. There was a group of serious researchers that really started to examine the phenomena in the 1950s and the 1960s, most notably a Latvian parapsychologist called Konstantin Raudiva. And he studied the phenomena for many, many years and produced an excellent book on the subject called Breakthrough. But more recently, there has been a sort of second wave of electronic voice phenomena research, and this involves, and it comes about because technology has allowed it, whereas in Raudiva's day, he was using big reel-to-reel recorders, and later, towards the end of his period of research, cassette recorders were just starting to become available. But we have easy access digital recorders. And that gave rise to this idea of taking them to haunted houses and recording the sounds, recording interactions with the spirits, asking out, is there for a response? Is there anybody there? Can you hear my voice? Can you tell me your name? Then pausing and playing back the recording. And with modern digital recordings, of course, you don't even have to rewind the tape and wait. You can get the response straight away. Then there was in the sort of early 2000s, there was an American inventor called Frank Sumption who created this device called which he called his box, Frank's box, what it was essentially was a couple of car radios, AM car radios, that he'd broken the tuning circuits in, so that the radio never stopped scanning. It went from one end of the dial to the other continually, over and over and over. He made a claim that this was being used, or this radio, broken radio, was a means for the spirits to communicate with the living, because they could manipulate the audio in some way in order to reply to his answer, to his question. So he would ask a question into thin air and listen to the radio for the reply. And of course, now we've got, as soon as the idea hit the television screens, everybody rushed out to Tandy and Radio Shack in the USA and started smashing their own radios, and you had the Shack Hack, and now you've got the SB7 and the SB11 spirit boxes, which do more or less the same thing. They're essentially small portable radios that never stop tuning. But I don't really have the time or the interest in trying to talk to spirits, because they, for me, electronic voice phenomena is really more in line with the 50s and 60s ideas of a group of researchers who were working in dedicated electronic voice phenomena laboratories, trying to effect a communication with another dimension, another realm. There were different explanations given, but they were getting really quite extraordinary results. They were getting two-way correspondence taking place. They were getting intelligent responses to questions that they were asking. And that really, really intrigues me. But that was done under very controlled conditions in laboratories where they could demonstrate that there was no outside interference from radios or that there was no other sort of easy explanation. The idea of taking a $20 radio or a $15 recorder into a graveyard or a haunted house and asking the spirits to speak to you and then listening back to all of the noises. Unfortunately, our brains tend to try and make sense of sound. And if we hear an unusual sound that sounds a little bit like speech, we will make a word out of it. Our brain will just do that automatically. It's hardwired to do that. And many of the sounds, when you actually examine them, are just sound-alikes. They're simulacres. They're noises that sound like speech. A bit like Sparky the Magic Piano. But people want them to be spirits. They want the dead to be communicating. And so you end up mired in people's desires and wishes and beliefs. And I know an awful lot of people are going to probably screaming now at the radio and shouting, but I've got lots of really good EVPs and you don't know what you're talking about. But for me, I'm more interested in what I can do with the recordings and the human experience rather than trying to talk directly to the dead people via a broken radio or a recorder.
You are actually the first paranormal investigator I've ever talked to that doesn't use EVP. I want to talk more about your investigations, Steve, if you don't mind. Do you just investigate homes, or have you ever went in to check out any abandoned locations? Tell me more about what you do.
The places I investigate are not chosen by me, in terms of I don't say, oh, that looks like a creepy old building, or that looks like a deserted old castle. I follow the human experience. So a person will report that they've had an experience. It might be in a home, it might be in a castle, it might be in an abandoned old work, old office, it might be in an old derelict factory. But wherever people have experiences, and that really is in every sort of imaginable location, if there is a question to be asked, then they are the sort of locations that I will investigate. But I've never done what I call speculative metal detecting ghost hunting, where you look at a building and think, that looks really creepy and I'd really like to spend time there and see if it's got any ghosts. I wait until there has been a report. Because what I'm really interested in is studying the human experience, because we can't directly understand the paranormal yet. And our only mechanism of gaining any form of understanding is the witness. So it's really trying to understand what they experienced. What did they hear? What did they see? So the very first step in every investigation is to listen to what they've got to say, because they were there when it happened. So they make the choice of the location, not me.
Okay, so now I know that, and I'm going to put a label on another type of haunting, and that's poltergeists, because they are thought to be the noisiest. Okay, so I want to know if you have ever talked to someone that has experienced a genuine poltergeist type haunting. Have you ever talked to them to see, what they experienced exactly, and see if you can learn something from that?
Oh, for several times. I've been fortunate enough to investigate poltergeist cases. I say fortunate because they tend to only last a few weeks or a few months. So they build up and then they peak and then they fade away and are gone. So you've got to be in the almost in the right place at the right time to. But I have been fortunate to have investigated a number of poltergeist cases and indeed experienced firsthand some of the activity of the poltergeist.
Okay, can you tell us about some of that?
Yeah, I mean, really dull stuff, you know, none of this exciting television stuff that you see. Perhaps, you know, one of the most bizarre, myself and another, we never investigate alone. We always investigate in pairs. But myself and another investigator were waiting in the kitchen of a house in which poltergeist activity had been reported. And it seemed to be around the peak of the activity, judging by the reports, and lots of stuff had happened. And you're right, poltergeists are supposed to be the most noisy. I mean, the very word poltergeist comes from the German words poltern, geist, noisy ghost. So we rounded up the family, and they were all in the one room watching television. And we were doing some measurements in the kitchen, I think, at the time, when a pair of rolled up socks appeared down the stairs at quite some force. They were thrown down the stairs and went bouncing across the hallway, much to our surprise and astonishment, because we knew that all of the family members were present in one room downstairs, and this pair of socks had appeared from the upper floor. So that was, I mean, that's, poltergeists tend to be relatively benign and playful. I think the analogy of having a naughty three-year-old or a naughty pet is more akin to the reality of a poltergeist than anything Hollywood or the television ghost hunting programs would have you believe. They're certainly not, and there's no evidence to suggest, from my own research and from that going back 150 years with the Society of Psychical Research, that indicates that poltergeists are any more evil, wicked, or unpleasant. You know, they're just an irritation, and very can be very, very disruptive for a short period of time. But yeah, they typically start off, and sound is one of the very first indicators of a poltergeist. They typically start off by scratching or rapping quite quietly. People might think that they've got an infestation of rodents, or that there's a bird trapped in a fireplace or behind a chimney or between walls. And then the phenomena grows in intensity and duration, and more extreme things happen. Objects start to move about or are displaced. Things might be thrown about or might fall over or might appear or disappear in unexpected ways. Then the phenomena, in some very, very rare cases, and I'm talking perhaps in, you know, poltergeists themselves are incredibly rare, but perhaps in one in 1,000 poltergeist cases, the disruption would become quite severe, with large object movement, so perhaps tables actually upending or larger items of furniture. Perhaps the most extreme example that I can give took place in England in the 1970s, and it was the famous Enfield poltergeist, which was researched and investigated at the time by the Society for Psychical Research, and very well documented by the investigators involved. But one of the phenomena there included levitation of members of the family, but perhaps the most astonishing of all, a solid cast iron fire surround was wrenched from the wall. Now, what that takes an incredible amount of force to do it. So, but as with all poltergeists, within a relatively short period of time, typically just a few months, the phenomena tends to fade away. People often associate poltergeists with teenage children. They say that around the age of puberty, these phenomena become more extreme. But that's simply a notion that remains unproven. There are just as many poltergeist cases that affect adults. And also, interestingly, there's a lot of phenomena that take place when the person who's supposedly the focus, so for example, the child or the person for whom the poltergeist is said to be sort of focused upon or concentrated or as a result of, isn't present. So again, it's a large unknown area where things don't conform to our nice idea of putting them into boxes.
I'm wondering if that home where that haunting took place is still standing. Do you know?
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely still standing. It's a nice, quiet, suburban house on the outskirts of London. It's been quiet now for the last 30 years, just a normal suburban house.
I'll tell you what, that haunting was something else. I would love to have interviewed, I think his name's Guy.
Yeah, Guy Lyon Playfair, friend.
Yeah, have you ever talked to him?
I know Guy quite well, and I've been fortunate enough to meet him on and off down the years. He has some very strong opinions, particularly after the Conjuring 2 movie was released, which was a fictional account of the Enfield case, based very loosely, extremely loosely, on the idea that the Warrens, Ed and Lorraine Warren, had visited London and had investigated the case, and which didn't actually take place. It was a work of Hollywood fiction. It was a good film nonetheless, but Guy was quite animated in his defense of the investigators and the reality of the case. But it is a fascinating, fascinating account. And sound played a very important part, you know, throughout the Enfield case. The famous recordings of Janet, where the daughter speaking with the voice of the older man, Bill, who was supposedly using her vocal cords. And when the recordings were examined and listened to by speech therapists, they said that the girl's vocal cords should not have been able to have made these sounds. But also, we talked about this, the very first question about science. There were investigators who came along at the time, and Joe Nickell has notably said, well, you know, because the girls were doing it the whole time. They were responsible for everything that took place there. But that ignores the fact that a great deal of activity took place and was witnessed to take place when the girls weren't present. Or was simply beyond the ability. I mean, I don't know many 11 or 12-year-old girls who could wrench a solid iron fireplace from a wall.
And since you've talked to him, I want to know if the pictures of the girls levitating, if that was real.
The photographs are absolutely genuine. They were taken by a news photographer who was investigating. They did try to establish the use of video recording, very early video recording. Remember that this was before the advent of the sort of home camcorders. And so they got in a team, I believe it was from Cambridge, with some dedicated video recording equipment to try and actually capture the levitation using video rather than just still photography. But they had a great deal of equipment problems with the video recording apparatus. But the photographs themselves, I have no doubt that they are genuine photographs, that they're not staged. And Guy is absolutely resolute that the photographs are not, as Joe Nickell might say, the girl simply bouncing up and down on the bed, being captured mid-flight. So I don't doubt for a minute that those photographs represent some genuine, abnormal, paranormal phenomena.
All right. I'm glad I asked you that question. He was in a position to investigate a case of a lifetime, so...
That's it. As I said before, with poltergeists, you have to be very fortunate. They're incredibly rare cases, and they don't last very long. And Guy and Maurice Gross, Maurice Gross was actually the first investigator. Guy he came along.
He stayed the longest, right?
No, the two of them did. Maurice Gross, who sadly passed away a few years ago, was effectively the lead investigator. Guy had investigated and had indeed written a book about poltergeist cases he'd investigated in South America. And Maurice, who was first to start the investigation at Enfield, was happy to receive the assistance of Guy because of Guy's expertise, having already examined the South American cases, which he'd also written about in a previous book. So the two investigators then collaborated and worked as a team on the case. Guy was first and foremost a journalist and an author, so he was the one who committed the investigation to the book, This House is Haunted, the account of the Enfield poltergeist. And Maurice, as I say, unfortunately passed away several years ago before the movie and before a new awakening of interest in the case.
All right, very good. Now, Steve, before we go, I want you to tell my listeners what they can learn from your book, Paracoustics.
Well, Paracoustics was written because sound is so important, and there are a lot of questions that we get asked about sound, about electronic voice phenomena, about the very... So in order to answer the questions, Dr. Cal Cooper and myself decided that it would be a good idea to try to put out a book that answered as many of those questions as was possible, given that, you know, the restrictions of the publisher. The original idea for the book probably would have been four times as many pages and about four times the cost. But what we wanted to answer is to address two audiences. The first was the investigation community, those who are out there in the haunted houses, in the seance rooms, who are dealing with sound. So giving them the information and the tools to be able to study the phenomena that they're experiencing and encountering, and to understand what it is that might be taking place. The second was to deal with the parapsychology community, these scientists who are first and foremost often trained in psychology and not physics. Now, of course, physics, sound is really physics. And they actually come out of university quite ill-equipped to deal with physical measurements, so sound recording or taking temperatures. So it was to provide them with course material and a resource that they could use, and to gather it together into one space, into one cover. So the book actually considers, right from the basics, it looks at the physics of sound, it looks at the equipment and the techniques for recording sound, it looks at the psychology of sound and why it's important. But then beyond that, we realise that there are actually a number of people who are working in sound-related areas, or where sound is related to the paranormal. Those in EVP research, for example, there are those who are studying sound from specifically the raps and noises in seance rooms. There are those who are studying the telephone calls from the dead, and that's Dr. Cooper's main area of expertise. There are also those that look at the psychology or the effects of sounds within music or sounds within shamanism. The significance of sound in beyond just our day-to-day experiences of the paranormal, but in a wider sense. So it looks at at more the spiritual idea of sound. And then it ends up with ideas, tools, basic guides on how to record and how to investigate electronic voice phenomena. It looks at the types of sound that we can't ordinarily hear. So, for example, very low frequency sound that's called infrasound, that's the frequency is so low that we're not able to perceive it. And equally, at the other end of the scale, you've got ultrasound, which is the very high frequency sound that, that the dog can hear when you blow the dog whistle, but you can't hear anything. But and yet our brains and our bodies are responding to these stimuli, these sound waves, in ways that, that can catch us off guard. We can't hear these invisible sounds with our ears, but they affect us in quite dramatic ways, surprising ways that people might interpret as being paranormal, because they can't hear them, they can't smell them, they can't taste them, and yet they're having these extraordinary effects on people, that if they're in a haunted house or their beliefs are pre-existing, that it's going to be paranormal. If they have these strange experiences, they attribute them to a paranormal cause.
Very good. Steve, do you have a website where my listeners can go?
Yes, indeed. It's all one word, but it's actually, there's no gaps. It's theghosthunter.webs.com. And I found there, it's not just one book. There's actually a second book called Ghostology, which explores the broader topic of ghost investigation. That's specifically about ghost hunting, Ghostology, the art of the ghost hunter. But they're both available. The links are on that web page, as indeed there are links to more research that relates to sound and other phenomena that investigators might encounter. So, for example, the orb phenomena.
Okay, very good. Stephen, best of luck to you. Many blessings.
Thank you.
And I appreciate your time.
No, it's been an absolute pleasure.
All right, that's going to do it for tonight's edition. I want to thank my special guest, Steve Parsons, for joining me. Make sure you pick up his book called Paracoustics. It is available on Amazon. And also visit his website at theghosthunter.webs.com. Don't forget to pick up your passes to see Nick Pope in person in Knoxville, Tennessee at the UT Conference Center on March the 14th, 2020, along with author and UFO researcher Peter Robbins. That is an exclusive event. There's only 250 seats available, and you can get tickets off alienexpo.com or by going to eventbrite.com. Also, if you like life after death type stuff, or you want to get a reading, or you've got something that you want to discuss about near-death experiences and want to see these phenomenal psychic mediums in person, I've got Chuck Bergman, the psychic cop, and Rob Guttrow, who is a psychic medium and pet psychic. He's going to be there as well at the UT Conference Center, March 14, 2020. Only 120 seats available. You can get those tickets as well off alienexpo.com or off eventbrite.com. I want to thank my producer tonight, Kim, and the Mysterious Radio team. I am your host, K-Town. Have a good night, and I will see you next time on Mysterious Radio.
Like the show? Get more Mysterious Radio on our website. And don't forget to visit our Twitter and Facebook page.